for my notes here. But as you guys well know, we are in the second offering of our I Am Convinced Apologetics series. Okay, this is the, I guess realistically the third, because I did an introductory. And then Bob kicked us off, and we're dealing with the idea here that God is for real. This whole series comes from a statement made by the venerable Apostle Paul, Paul of Tarsus, and he says, that is why I am suffering as I am. Yet this is no cause for shame, because I know whom I have believed and am convinced that he is able to guard what I have entrusted to him until that day. Now, what was it that convinced Paul so thoroughly of the existence of God and of the claims of Jesus Christ that he was willing, without even any shame or regret, to suffer because of it? What convinced him? Well, you guys know, if you've read the Bible, you know that repeatedly Paul claims over and over again, he brings up this story, this experience he had when he was going down this road to the city of Damascus, and all of a sudden this brilliant light comes on the scene, puts him to his knees, and a voice comes out of the light and claims to be none other than Jesus Christ. And from that day forward, Paul had additional encounters with Jesus. And that settled all doubt. He was convinced in whom he believed. Guys, suffice it to say that radical encounters with truth produce radical results. And Paul's life is a testimony to that. And it's Bob and my hope that this apologetics series will have the same effect, that it would fill some of the more serious holes of doubt in your life, such that you too, myself included, will live equally radical lives for God in our day. That's the purpose. We want to seriously reduce the amount, the number of times that we live like unbelievers in our lives. Now, besides my own salvation experience and my own personal encounters with Christ afterwards, the two things that keep snapping me back to the reality that God exists, that God is for real, is this. One is this logical elimination of all the other possibilities to explain reality except for God. And that's the one I'm going to share with you today. The other is the witness from creation itself from a geological point of view, which was my major in college. And that one will be in 2 weeks. I call my reality checks Descartes and dinosaurs. That's what I call it. Sometimes, you know, you get stupid in the head. You're thinking, hey, this would be a good time to sin. And I remember, Descartes and dinosaurs, can't do it. Because those two words trigger a number of thoughts in my head that I cannot get around. I cannot circumvent them. I can't explain them away. They are so, in my mind, so solid that I am convinced. I was a new campus missionary at Iowa State University, and I was exposed to a video presentation by a gentleman called by the name of R.C. Sproul. Many of you may know him, or at least know of him. And in this video, he presented what I'm going to be sharing with you today, the four possibilities that prove the existence of God. The four possibilities proof is what he would call it. The four possibilities proof. And by proof, I mean radical proof that compels a radical person to acquiesce to that rational proof. That's what I mean. And it's radical proof that compels a rational person, compels a rational person to acquiesce or to give into, to surrender, to agree with that rational proof. So after I heard R.C. Sproul's presentation, I became aware that through a process of rational thought and logic, supported by scientific laws, the existence of God is an absolute necessity. It is a foregone conclusion. And that for me to think or to entertain otherwise puts me in the category of the illogical and the absurd. I know. You're thinking, enough introduction. Let's hear it. Okay, Bob, last week, introduced a key component of this proof when he mentioned the universally accepted law called the first law of thermodynamics, which essentially boils down to the fact that matter or energy, because all matter is energy, can neither be created nor destroyed. Essentially boils down to that. It's a reworking of the law of the conservation of energy. And so, if that being true, in fact, all of human experience, all of it, agrees with that. That's why it's a law. All of human experience agrees that matter, energy, can neither be created nor destroyed. It begs the question, then where did it come from? Bob even posed the question. Then where did it come from? In other words, guys, where did reality come from? This reality that you're experiencing, this stage, where did it come from? The air that I just sucked into my lungs, where did that come from? The chair that you're sitting on, where did it come from? You, me, where did we come from? How did anything that is here get here? How did anything get here if it cannot be created nor destroyed? Guys, the simplest statement for the existence of God that I'm just going to give to you now, I'm just going to tip my hand, here it is. The simplest statement is that if anything exists, then God exists. So if you're prone to falling asleep, you have now heard the essence of my message. If anything exists, God exists. So, the foundational premise, the foundational premise of philosophy, of logic, is this: ex nihilo nihil fit. It means out of nothing, nothing comes. Basically, it is stating that if at any time, in all of eternity, there was absolutely nothing, then there will always be absolutely nothing. The way we like to put it is, You'll never get something from exactly. That's what all that is saying. You're not going to get something from nothing. And so, if something exists now, then something has had to have always existed, because you'll never get something from nothing. Are you tracking with that one? Have you been able to wrap your mind around that much? Okay. So, to explain the existence of reality, to explain why it's here as we are experiencing it, as we encounter it, there are only four possibilities. It's either an illusion. It's really not here after all. This is just an illusion. It's not actually real. Or two, it's self-created. This very reality that we're experiencing created itself. Or three, it is self-existent. It's always been here. It is eternal, this reality that we experience. Or four, it was created by something that's self-existent. Those are the only four possibilities. R.C. Sproul, the man of renown, has delivered this address, this argument, to many different audiences of philosophers, of scientists, in realms of academia, and he has found that no matter how the variations and the different ways of categorizing and the claiming and explaining the different explanations of reality that they might give you, no matter what form or fashion it comes in, they all will fall under one of these four categories. None other options exist. So he claims. And I'm inclined to believe his testimony. So let's take a look at him. That first possible option, that everything is an illusion. None of this is real. It's all an illusion. It's a fig Newton of my imagination. You're not here. I'm not here. This is not happening. Want to get away? You know, that's what we think. Okay. Now, at face value, this makes you laugh in your innards because you can't seem to really take this option as serious, but believe me, it was taken very seriously during the Enlightenment period, and it's still popular among certain Eastern religions to this day, such as Buddhism. Now, an individual came to the scene by the name of René Descartes, and he responded to this idea that all of reality is an illusion with much vigor, and he has now established this famous quote, "I think, therefore I am." Okay, have you anybody heard that one before? "I think, therefore I am." That's René Descartes. Now, to this, I was sharing this thought, well seasoned, well sifted, with my wife, and she says, "I think you're putting Descartes before the horse." Well, I think that they certainly did during the Enlightenment period, but let's move on. So here's what he's saying. If nothing is real and it's all an illusion, then we have to explain the reality of the illusion. If I'm currently having this illusion that I'm on this stage talking to you about all of reality being illusion, I need to account to the fact that I'm up here on this stage having this illusion. I've got to explain that's happening. The way Descartes put it this way. He says, "Since I am doubting, I must doubt that I'm doubting, which proves that I am indeed doubting." That's what philosophy does to you, people. Okay? And it's a fascinating statement. I thought, whoa, there's a lot of meat in that. And I thought, what has happened to me? So in other words, he's saying this, the reality of the experience of the illusion proves that there must be a reality which disproves that it's an illusion. I hope you got that. So, I hate to break it to you guys, but this life is for real. As much as you'd like it to be otherwise at times. Descartes' full quote, "I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am." So if you're thinking right now, as hard as that might be, it proves that you are existing. The illusion possibility has got to be discarded because thought proves that something exists. Got it? Number two. That the universe was self-created. Now, this one as well might seem at its introductory level to be absolutely absurd at face value. But in various forms, this idea is the most popular explanation for the existence of the universe provided today. The idea that matter in some form or fashion by some means was self-created is held roughly by about 95% of scientists, the other 5% maintaining that matter is eternal. Now let me give you some examples of self-creation thought shrouded in scientific language over time. The first one I'll pick on is the idea of spontaneous generation. It's this idea that was well entrenched in academia because they observed that when they would see this puddle of water form after a rain, and it's been there for a couple of days, and later they would find little things in there. They find these little frog eggs in there. And they thought, whoa, it's just popped out of nowhere. It was water, and now there's fish eggs. Or there was a dead carcass along the road. And after 2 or 3 days, whoa, there's like these maggots. They just showed up out of nowhere. They believed in spontaneous generation. This was popular during the Enlightenment period as well, and it was used as scientific justification to abolish what they were calling the God hypothesis. Yeah, that tells you just how far the mind can get off track. Okay, well, this idea shouldn't have taken hold in the first place because it completely violates the ground foundational idea of ex nihilo nihil fit, out of nothing, nothing comes, so you can't get something spontaneously popping out of nowhere from nothing. So it shouldn't have even gotten any traction, but indeed it didn't go away until Louis Pasteur in 1859 performed various experiments that proved once and for all that you really can't get something from nothing. Thank you, Pasteur. Or did he? Indeed, over the course of time, science has found a way to hold on to spontaneous generation by replacing it with, shall we say, gradual spontaneous generation. Saying this, that in the ancient past, over long periods of time, you actually could get something from nothing. Right. Well, a rather well-known astrophysicist was speaking about the enormous progress made in the scientific realm via the Hubble telescope. And during his delivery, he stated that 15 to 18 billion years ago, the universe exploded into being, which means it just came about. It just happened. It came into being. It didn't exist, and now it is. This idea that the universe exploded into being was further supported by a Nobel Prize scientist who stated this: you can't get something out of nothing quickly. It takes time. So given enough time, you actually can get something from nothing. Guys, you just got to be patient, right? Now, this idea is not even a new thought. Back in 1954, a fellow by the name of George Wald wrote an article for the Scientific American, and he wrote this: time is in fact the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years, which is how old they thought the universe was at that time. We now know it's 15 to 18 billion. But at that time, it was only 2 billion. Okay, moving on. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. The possible, probable, and the probable, virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles. I'm just going to pause for effect. Let that one sit in as I ask you a question. What is time? Can time perform anything? All the more can it form a miracle? What is time? Time is a measurement. It's a thing that we use to measure the progress of events for our benefit. If there was ever a time when there was absolutely nothing, then even after a million billion years, you're still going to have absolutely nothing, because time can't really do anything. It is simply a measure of the passage of events. So all time can do is watch stuff happen. Get that? Time can watch things. All time can do is watch. Get that? I know, it's bam! I thought, that is classic. I should actually get that copyrighted. But that's all it can do is watch stuff happen. All it can do. So, during a discussion on the origin of the universe, a scientist made this fatal error by claiming that the world came into being by chance. It came into being by chance. Let me ask you guys another question, letting it soak in. Came into being by chance. Guys, what is chance? Again, chance is simply a term that we use to describe mathematical probabilities. What are the odds if I could catch a quarter? What are the odds if I flip a quarter into the air that it'll come up heads or tails? Of course, it'll be 100%. It'll either be heads or tails. If I flip a quarter up in the air, what are the chances it'll be heads? 50%. If I put it in a controlled environment where the air is a vacuum and it's the same lift every single time, the same number of flips every time, will that influence how many times it goes up heads or tails? Well, yes, it would. Because what are we saying when we say chance? We're saying, whoa, there are so many variables going on. When you flip that quarter, it's the force of the flip. It's how high it goes. It's how many times it flips in the air. It's we got the pressure of the gravity. It's density going on. We've got temperature factors. It's where you catch it in the air. Oh, my goodness, it's too much to think of. I'll just call it chance. That's all it is. It's a word that we use to measure mathematical probability. When you toss a quarter in the air, or roll a dice, or whatever it is. But here it is, in popular jargon, chance has been elevated from a term to actually having causal power. That chance can actually do something. But chance is not something that can do something. It has no being. Therefore, it has no power. It's not a thing. Chance is no thing. Let me say that faster. Chance is no thing. I'll say it even faster. Chance is nothing. It's nothing. It's not a thing. So it's a logical impossibility that the world would have been created by nothing. That's what is being said. So to say that the universe is created by chance is the same as saying that the universe was created by nothing. Guys, this is the worst kind of mythology. Chance has simply become a word to describe our ignorance. So, self-creation is false by definition. For something to create itself would mean it's its own cause. It has to exist before it existed. Let me put it another way. It had to be before it was. I'll put it another way. It had to be and not be at the same time and in the same relationship, which violates the law of non-contradiction and that puts this option in the category of pure irrationality. So, we will have to discard the idea that our reality is self-created. How about self-existence? There's got to be something. There's got to be something, guys. For something to exist now, something has had to have always existed. Somewhere, somehow, something has to be self-existent for anything to exist. So what this is saying is that there has got to be something out there that has the power to exist in and of itself, that it would inherently possess the quality of eternality, that it's eternal. Because if it didn't, it would have to be created. Something has got to be eternal for anything to exist. And this is oftentimes called the first cause. Now, in the world of atheism, materialism specifically argues or assumes that matter itself is self-existent. But what do you mean when you say matter is self-existent? Is this stage self-existent? Has it always been and will always be? Well, no, obviously this stage came into being sometime. Somebody created it, and it's certainly changing over time. Just ask Bob. He's always fixing something. This thing is falling apart. It is not staying the same. In fact, guys, that is a chief characteristic of matter in our universe, is that it's mutable. And by mutable, that word means that it's changing. Matter changes over time from one state into another state. It's constantly changing. Matter is in a constant state of becoming. It's becoming something else. It's not in the state of pure being. So obviously, the atheist would say, come on, I am not claiming that the stage is self-existent, but that there is something deeply embedded in the cosmos that is some form of matter, some form of energy that has the power of being that exists within the universe, and it can generate everything into being. Now, in secular circles, they would argue that the necessary self-existent entity is the universe itself. Now, the story is one that you may be familiar with, that in some eternally distant past, you have this singularity where all the matter in the universe existed in some native form. And it was there for all eternity and existed in perfect uniformity until, for some unknown reason, it exploded. And gradually, over time, it formed gases and heavier elements, and you'd get your stars and your planets and your, hello, here I am. Okay? You guys know that story. And they're now saying, whoa, and now the condition of the universe as it is going back to this state of perfect organization or uniformity, which essentially is death. The back where nothing is happening anymore. So does that story have the force of logic behind it? Guys, the other universally accepted law of science is the second law of thermodynamics. And it states that if any system, let's call it the universe, is left to itself, it will go towards greater entropy. That word entropy simply means non-available useful energy. In other words, disorder, randomness. It's saying it this way: all matter, or really all energy, moves from a state of order to disorder. That is the trend, that's universal human experience. Across the board, all things will move from a state of order to disorder. So, think about that one for a minute. Everything, all of matter, all of human experience tells us that this is a law. It's true universally. Everything is going from a state of order to disorder. Okay, this begs a question. Then how did all of this matter get organized in the first place? If it was this uniform singularity in some distant eternal past, how did it get to that condition? But then there's another law that comes into play. If it's in this state of perfect uniformity in some distant past, well, what about the law of inertia? You guys know the law of inertia. Anything that's in motion stays in motion unless acted on by another force. Or anything that's at rest stays at rest unless acted on by another force. And if this thing is at perfect rest, what was the force that caused it to explode? Why did it explode? And this is no cop-out. Because if you're claiming that the universe itself is eternal, and yet you have no cause that exploded it into being, you've got yourself a serious dilemma. What caused this Big Bang? Because time and chance can't do it. Because it can't do nothing. Anything. It can't do anything. There's got to even be an origin to motion. And that origin has to be in motion itself. So even though self-existence is necessary, matter does not possess the characteristics necessary for eternal being. It can't come from nothing. It won't do anything unless acted upon, and it won't stay in usable state forever. It's in continual process of becoming less usable, decaying. So if matter was self-existent, then logically and scientifically, we shouldn't be here right now to even talk about it. It leaves us with the only other possible option. Everything was created by something that was self-existent. We know of nothing in the natural realm that possesses the qualities of self-existence. Everything we know of and have experienced is contingent upon something else for its existence, cause and effect. And all contingent things are in constant change. The second law of thermodynamics is changing and decaying. Self-existent eternal entities, by contrast and by definition, have to be changeless. They can never lose anything over time. It will have to always be, and always must be, in order to be self-existent and eternal. It has to be in a state of pure being, not changing. Guys, this is exactly how God revealed himself to Moses in antiquity, in the scriptures. In Exodus 3, it states, Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. That phrase, I am, is where we get that phrase, Yahweh. It's the Hebrew word, Yahweh. It's I am who I am. He owes his existence to no one. He is the self-existent being, which is what the very first verse of the Bible even speaks of. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. No explanation, no flight into fancy trying to explain how God got there, where he came from. They just seem to intuitively understand that God is the self-existent one. That phrase, I am who I am, it's the same one that Jesus used of himself. In John 13, 19, he says, I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that Yahweh, I am who I am. And then in the book of Hebrews, it attributes the chief quality of self-existence to Jesus Christ when it says Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. Guys, thousands of years before modern science and philosophy came to bear, the scriptures expressed what we now know to be the only possible, logical, rational explanation for the existence of reality. That there's a self-existent being. His name is God. More specifically, Jesus Christ. And through him and by him, all things came into being. There are simply no other possibilities left to us. Lord Jesus, I want to thank you that embedded right in the scriptures itself, for those who have the discernment to see it, the humility to read it, you expose deep and profound truths that identify you as the one true God, the self-existent one who was and is and always will be. You're it. We don't have to wonder. We don't have to wring our hands. We don't have to read some scientific discovery and say, well, I guess that all comes undone. No, it is founded on solid, rational thought. There is a God. And he loves us so much that he invaded our time and space here on this planet. You laid down your life that we might believe and be with you forever. And that is indeed God, the desire of